From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made with the announcement from NASA that we are learning more about a faint star called TRAPPIST-1 and that there are seven Earth-sized planets orbiting it. Seven! They are so close together that if you were to stand on the surface of one of those planets, the others might appear as close as our moon appears to us. So pack your bags, everyone. We finally got somewhere to vacation or maybe to live permanently. Not quite, of course, and this week the University of Rochester has welcomed one of the most significant scientific minds anywhere. Dr. David Stevenson has been in town with a busy schedule this week, visiting and lecturing on subjects like planetary diversity. What do we know about whether our planet is special? How are planets formed? What do we know about that? Well, U of R astrophysicist Adam Frank, frequent guest in this program, told me that Dave Stevenson is a legend in his field, and I gladly concede from the outset. I will not be able to keep up with him intellectually, but we're going to try to have an interesting conversation this hour. Dr. Stevenson, it is our pleasure to have you here. Thank you.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Been a busy week for you, yes?
It has indeed been a very busy week, giving two talks, talking to lots of people, learning about all sorts of exciting science being done here, the University of Rochester, Laser Lab, and so forth. It's been a great week, but somewhat exhausting.
Somewhat exhausting. Well, we'll try to be somewhat relaxed and enjoy the conversation this hour. And we're going to explore this hour with Dr. Stevenson some questions on the Juno mission, what we know about formation of different planets of different sizes, frankly, how planets come to be formed, what we know about that. I want to start a little bit more broadly and ask you whether your career has given you more insight into whether you think our planet is special in any way.
Yes, I think that especially the last decade has been very exciting because we've found thousands of planets around other stars, and we see that they are, in most cases, quite different from the Earth. We're beginning to get some hints that perhaps the Earth is not so typical, that our solar system is not so typical, and maybe the Earth is not that common. On the other hand, there are so many planets that out there somewhere there will be something like the Earth.
Well, and this is where I think that may be a little bit confusing for people to hear your comments there, because if you read the headlines from NASA, just take the TRAPPIST-1 stories, you hear not just Earth size, but rocky. And you think, well, it's just like us here. But it looks like there's a number of variables that don't always line up with us.
Indeed. A lot of these planets, including those ones, are rather hot because they're close to the parent star. And that's one of the things that's different. In our solar system, we're sitting out at quite a large distance from the sun, quite a pleasant temperature. A lot of these planetary systems that we're finding elsewhere have the planets much closer into the star, which means that they're hotter.
I also have to give credit to Adam Frank for some of the lines of questioning here. It would have been better just to have him and you here for the hour. I'd take the hour off. But he couldn't do it. And one of the points that he was making in our conversation was, that Dr. Stevenson has done a lot of work understanding our moon. And the moon matters in a number of ways that we probably don't think about often, including climate. And Adam was saying Mars sort of wobbles, as an example. And if you wobble, you're more climate unstable, whereas if you have a moon like ours, it sort of keeps us in check. Is that all true?
Yes, that is all true. The seasons on the Earth and the way that ice is distributed is affected by the tilt of the Earth's rotation axis. And the moon keeps us in line. The moon is very helpful. Mars has a couple of small moons, but those moons are so small that they don't affect the spin axis of Mars. And so that spin axis, or wobble as you called it, is very large on Mars, on long timescales, not on the timescale of a week or a month, but on the timescale of hundreds of thousands of years.
Enough to impact climate, though?
You bet. So on Mars, there may have been times when the ice that is now at the poles was at the equator. That can be somewhat troublesome.
This just is a seed that has me thinking, we've talked with Adam about reworking the Drake equation and thinking about just the likelihood that we truly are alone as intelligent life. And one of the keys of creating intelligent life is not just to have a planet a sort of comfortable distance from a star, but also to have a planet that's reasonably, for lack of a better word, protected or stable, whether it's climate change and space impacts and everything else. And we've got not just this great distance, this perfect distance for us from our star, but we've got this big moon. And does that start to make it look unlikely to find life like ours elsewhere?
It is perhaps likely that the situation we have with our large moon is atypical, that although there may be Earth-like planets out there in the sense of having similar temperatures, size, mass, even similar atmosphere, some of them don't have a moon, and so they're not as stable. I do think, however, that when it comes to the question of life, we should not be so hung up on conditions like the Earth. I think there are many other places where you can have life, including in our solar system. Europa, Enceladus, these are moons that have oceans underneath ice shells. Even Pluto, we suspect, has an ocean at depth. So if you think that water and energy is sufficient for life, there may be many places, even in our own solar system, where you can have life. As for intelligent life, who knows? That is indeed the last part of the famous Drake equation. And I don't think we have a clue at this point. I don't think we know how to assess that number. That final number is how long an intelligent civilization survives. We may be on the way to destroying ourselves. Who knows? So that's an imponderable.
Is it a waste of time to ponder it?
It's not a waste of time to ponder, but I'm fond of getting data. And so I'm more interested in finding out things rather than just thinking about them.
Isn't there an argument, though, that rugby and Kardashians and iPhones don't really represent intelligent life anyway?
Indeed. Of course, in the past, people said that the signals we sent out to the intelligence elsewhere included I Love Lucy. I actually think I Love Lucy was a wonderful TV program, but that's what went out because, that was the signal from TV, which, of course, goes out to space.
All right, so before I get back to the moon, and we're going to work through a number of different subjects, one of the conversations we had with Adam came at a time when we were getting some data back from Pluto, that remarkable mission and the images that we were getting. Information and at least a close look that we had never had before. And one of the questions that came to mind for me as someone who is not a scientist is, what are the questions you think that we probably sadly will never be able to answer? And we had that kind of a discussion. And I wonder if you think this notion of intelligent life will never be answered or not in our lifetime be answered, not in many lifetimes. I mean, is that sort of an imponderable because you think it's not going to be within reach at any point?
I think it's possible that we will be lucky and get a signal from an extraterrestrial intelligence. I support SETI, which is the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. That's best done by radio astronomy, just by looking for signals from space that show information that suggests intelligent civilization sent it out. As I said, we don't really have a good way of guessing how many intelligent civilizations are out there. But let's face it, the galaxy has billions of stars. We now know that almost every star has a planet. Out there somewhere, it would seem likely that we have an intelligent civilization. And who knows what they're doing? Who knows whether they care? But Let's hope they're sending out a signal.
And so let's get back to our moon here, because if I were to come to you and say, Dr. Stevenson, we have confirmation of intelligent technological life on a planet somewhere, would you expect it to have a moon and a large moon like ours?
So that's a very interesting question. I've thought about that quite a lot. The interesting thing in our solar system is that Venus, which in many ways is like the Earth, it's not a nice place to live, but it's similar in mass and so forth, does not have a large moon. And my speculation is that Venus once did have a moon, but lost it. How can it lose it? Well, at the time that Venus had a moon, there were lots of other things wandering around, pushing objects around by their gravity. And in that way, Venus may have lost its moon. On the other hand, Earth's moon, our moon, formed late. It formed towards the end of the formation of Earth. And so it's a question of timing. The fact that we were the last interesting event to happen in our solar system, by we, I mean Earth and moon, may be an important part of understanding why we have kept our moon. And in other cases, bodies may lose moons. So that's part of the argument that makes me think that the Earth-Moon system is a little bit special.
And so let me reveal a little of my ignorance now. Do we know of other planets that have moons the size of ours?
Not terrestrial bodies. And we've not found moons around any of the planets outside our own solar system. Of course, in our own solar system, lots of planets have moons. They tend to be planets that are further out. They got their moons in a different way than we got ours. Jupiter got its set of wonderful moons through a process a little bit like a miniature solar system. So that kind of situation should be common. We haven't found it yet, but I think in the coming decade or two, we're going to find moons around other planets.
Listeners, if you've got questions or comments, this is a wonderful opportunity as we talk to Dr. David Stevenson, the Goldberger Professor of Planetary Science at Caltech. He's been in Rochester this week as a guest at the University of Rochester, lecturing, making presentations on a number of subjects, and this is a good chance to get your questions answered. 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. How come we only see one side of that moon?
Well, the moon is not a perfect sphere. It actually has a bulge that makes it stable so that if you were to go to the moon and give it a little kick to try and spin it into a different orientation, it would come back to where it is. So the answer is it's the way the material on the moon is distributed. Makes it stable, a little bit like a pendulum.
My understanding is one of your discussions this week on the moon was about a little bit of, I don't know if it's disagreement in the scientific community. I thought the notion of how the moon was formed was largely settled, no?
In one sense, it's settled. Almost everybody agrees that the moon was formed through a giant impact, a very large object hitting the Earth, causing a splash of material that went into Earth orbit, and that material then aggregated to make the moon. However, we have trouble explaining why the moon and the Earth are so similar, chemically similar. In particular, isotopes are very similar between the two planets, and that has led to some debate, certainly even some disagreement about the exact way in which you could end up with a moon that is so similar to the outer part, especially, of the Earth. And so some people favor more complicated stories. There's still giant impacts, but some of the stories involve the Earth undergoing fission, meaning that part of the Earth breaks away from itself to form the moon, albeit through a process that still involves a giant impact.
So space is, obviously, it's pretty big, mostly empty, and getting things to collide in space, I think with our limited imagination, seems like it would happen all the time. But in reality, the vastness of space might make it seem like collisions would be difficult, pretty rare. You know, how have scientists, you know, sort of evolved in their thinking about the role of impacts in the shaping of planets?
So early on, you have lots of objects, and it's more likely that they hit each other. It's also true that actually the impacts are uncommon. After all, it takes the Earth 1 year to go around the sun. But if you wait 100 million years, you have 100 million opportunities for bodies to hit each other. And so if you wait long enough, they will collide. But that's not true in our current solar system because most of the garbage has been cleaned up and there's not much left, except, of course, in the asteroid belt.
It's a pretty clean space, yes?
It's clean out where we are. There's not much stuff in space near where we are. You have to go quite a way to find something else.
And so this is one of the things Adam and I were talking about. What would it be like to watch one of these impacts, like the one that sort of, for lack of better, the technical term I think is spit out the moon?
Well, you certainly don't want to be too close because there's a hell of a lot of energy released. And after the impact, the Earth will be radiating at about 2,000, 3,000 Kelvin, which is really hot. And that means that if you were so fortunate as to see this happen, living, of course, around another star, so you're a long way away, but looking at us, you would see a bright glow close to the sun, but only for 100 years or 1,000 years. So you'd have to be a little bit lucky because, after all, this event only happens you know, once in 50 million years or something like that. So it's a bit of luck involved. However, that would be a spectacular event. And I think actually that there's a chance that we will see something like that. If we're patient and we look at other places, not places that have planets now, but places where planets are forming. That means the star is very young, there's a disk. If you're lucky, you will actually see an impact. We've actually seen smaller impacts. I've been involved in that. We have seen instances in disks where things collide and they produce a flash of infrared radiation. So we know that this is possible. But let's be patient and maybe we will see an event like the one that caused our moon. That would be exciting.
Let me get our first phone call. It's Tom in Greece on with Dr. Stevenson. Go ahead, Tom.
Yes. Thank you for taking my call. I was wondering if there was a time when the moon was much closer to the Earth than it is now. I mean, early in the Earth's history, say maybe in the time of the dinosaurs, or, well, much more recently in the time of the early humans, if it was much closer and looked larger than it does now.
So if you go back to when the Earth formed, yes, we think the moon was very close. However, it moves away very quickly to begin with in the early history of the Earth. There's a very strong tidal effect when the moon is close. So it starts at 3 Earth radii. It's now at 60. If you go back to the time of the dinosaurs, there's not that big a change. But actually, the moon is still moving away from the Earth. We can see that. It's moving away at 15 centimeters per year. It doesn't sound like much, but it adds up. Here's something we know. We know that 200 million years ago, the length of day on the Earth was 22 hours rather than the current 24 hours. Now, you might say, how is that telling you where the moon is? Well, it tells you because what's happening is that the Earth is slowing down its spin because it's transferring angular momentum to the moon. So the two things are tied to each other. The Earth spins down, the moon moves out. The Earth started out with a five-hour day, the moon close. Now we're at a 24-hour day. But if you go back 200 million years, which is quite a bit earlier than the dinosaurs, the length of day was 22 hours. We know that from looking at corals and how they grow. So that's, if you will, fossil evidence. And the moon was a bit closer, to be sure, although not by a lot. And if you were wandering around on the Earth at that time and looking at the moon, I'm not sure you would notice. Of course, right now, the moon has a different appearance in the sky because the moon is not in a circular orbit. So the size of the moon as we see it right now changes a bit.
Does that help, Tom?
Yes, all right. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom. I appreciate that. 844-295-TALK. If you want to call the program, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. This is Jonathan next. Go ahead, Jonathan.
By the way, thank you for taking the call.
Sure.
My question is that if the Earth and the Moon, they're, you know, obviously the Earth's a lot larger, but what's the theory behind why life or some forms of life didn't develop on the moon, but they did on Earth? Like, you know, how did we get the atmosphere and the moon didn't get an atmosphere, so to speak? So,
yeah, Jonathan, thank you very much.
So the main difference is size. The moon is only a little bit more than 1% the mass of the Earth. That makes a big difference for the gravity. Gravity on the moon is 1/6 of that on the Earth. If you try and put an atmosphere around the moon, you tend to lose it rather quickly. It doesn't stay around, and so the moon is not a particularly nice place. It's close to a vacuum. It's hot enough. That's not a problem, although because there's no atmosphere, it gets extremes of temperature. So it's not a particularly nice place, mainly because you can't keep an atmosphere around. Already, when you go up to the mass of Mars, which is a factor of 10 larger, you start to get into a state where you can keep enough atmosphere that you can make a place where life can be sustained. And indeed, many people think that Mars once had life. We're looking for it. There are even some people who think that there's simple life on Mars right now, although it's probably hiding underneath the surface.
So the moon, not big enough for an atmosphere, roughly speaking?
Correct.
Not big enough for an atmosphere. So no atmosphere, not the kind of place you want to be. The moon's like Henrietta. So anyway, I'm just kidding, people in Henrietta. You know, we always have our little punching bags. No, I love Henrietta. But I'm glad that we're having this discussion with Dr. David Stevenson, the Goldberger Professor of Planetary Science at Caltech, who has spent the week in Rochester as a guest of the University of Rochester, answering our questions and yours as we talk about planetary diversity. What in your career has changed the most in terms of how we understand the formation of planets?
I would say that it is the recent discovery of planets around other stars, because we had this idea that we understood our solar system, rocky planets close into the sun, and then you got out to where water ice formed and you had a lot more stuff, and so you could have Jupiter and Saturn and Uranus and Neptune. And then we started finding giant planets, Jupiter-like planets, close in to other stars. They're called hot Jupiters because they're hot. And this was a big surprise. This turned over the field to some extent, because we didn't think that you would have Jupiter-like planets close into stars. Now, those are actually not the most common, but that revolutionized our ideas. And even now, with thousands of planets found around other stars, we're finding that a lot of those planets are close into the star. And that's really somewhat surprising. It suggests that our solar system is not typical.
Does it excite you?
Yes, it does. I think always in science, you'd like to be challenged. You should be humble enough to recognize the value of being shown wrong. And let's face it, that's how science progresses, by throwing out old ideas.
Well, one of the things that truly fascinates me about science is how often scientists are able to understand something that they are likely going to be able to discern or discover in the future, but without the current evidence. And that's not to say wild predictions or just ideas, but looking at different signatures or ideas on what we're going to understand with better technology, better observation. I like to think we're going to find Dyson swarms that indicate that civilizations have mined the energy of their stars. That's more of just a concept or an idea, despite what we saw with Yale postdoc Tabitha Boyajian's star recently. But I want to ask you, what haven't we sort of officially discerned or discovered, but you think is likely going to be discovered at some point? That would be a neat moment for science.
I think by far the most important discovery in the future will be finding life elsewhere than on Earth. At the moment, we have just one example. Of course, if we were to find life on Mars, there's a possibility that it's very similar to life on Earth. There's even the possibility that it came from Mars. But if you could find life on Europa, or if you could find evidence for intelligent life elsewhere in the universe, that would be revolutionary. I think that would be the greatest scientific discovery. And I'm actually reasonably optimistic, although I also profess to a substantial degree of ignorance, because the fact of the matter is that since we only have one example of life, it's very hard to say something sensible, something quantitative about life elsewhere.
And right on cue, here's Brian on Twitter, who wants to know, is there evidence that a fluid other than water could support life on another planet or moon?
So that's a very interesting question. I have colleagues who are thinking about that. I think that water is a wonderful way to go. It worked for us. And there are lots of neat features about water, but maybe you can have complicated enough chemistry, for example, in liquid hydrocarbons, which is what you have on the surface of Titan. There are lakes on the surface of Titan of ethane and methane in liquid form. Some people think you can do exotic chemistry in those situations. I think that's an open question. If you view life as the means of storing information, almost sounds like artificial intelligence, but in a way the things are related, then there might be other very exotic ways of doing it that we haven't found yet. However, I do think that water is such a wonderful medium in which to do the chemistry that we know can produce life on Earth, that that's the natural place to look first. And so you go where the water is. As it happens, water is very common. It's all over the place. On Earth, we don't have that much, actually. It's only one part in a thousand of the Earth's mass. But if you go elsewhere in the solar system, in the outer solar system, it's very common.
All right, so we're late for our only break of the hour. And we come back, we're going to take more of your questions and comments for Dr. David Stevenson, our guest for the hour, professor of planetary science at Caltech, who is in Rochester lecturing this week on a number of subjects. We haven't even gotten to the thing that excites him most right now, which is the Juno mission. So we're going to talk about that next and talk more about the origin of planets and what we know. Could be talking about our own future here with one of the great minds of science anywhere. Short break and more with that next. Coming up in our second hour, Black Panther, the movie, is breaking box office records, doing huge numbers, but the film is more than just great entertainment. It's become important for a whole lot of people, and we're going to talk about the impact of Black Panther, what it means now, why it took so long to make this film, and what it means going forward. That's next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. So what's going on with the Juno mission?
So the Juno mission is a spacecraft in orbit around Jupiter right now. It's been there for almost 2 years. It's collecting information close in. We've had a spacecraft in the past go to Jupiter, but for the most part, they've been standoffish. The spacecraft have often focused their attention on the very interesting moons. But this is a mission that is designed to really get at the heart of Jupiter, to understand what's going on inside Jupiter. How does Jupiter work? How does it make its magnetic field? Is there a core at the center? And you might ask, well, why do this? And the answer in part is that we think Jupiter is a key to understanding our solar system, and perhaps even a key to understanding Earth itself, because Jupiter formed first, and Jupiter was the big bully. It has so much mass that it exerts its influence on bodies elsewhere. It sends stuff to us. It's sending meteorites to us right now. It may be responsible for the water that we have on Earth. It may be responsible for you, for us. So you should be thankful to Jupiter.
Yeah, thankful, but it's also sending meteorites?
Yeah, so it's sending bad stuff as well as good stuff.
comets as well? What is deriving from Jupiter?
So most of the stuff that Jupiter may be responsible for arrived early and fortunately included water. Jupiter is an equal opportunity disturber. It sends stuff inwards as well as outwards, and some of the things that it sends on its way leave our solar system. Jupiter can eject as well as send stuff to us. Comets, actually, more likely the comets that usually visit us were first placed where they are by Uranus and Neptune rather than Jupiter, but Jupiter has a role to play there too.
And you said Jupiter was first in our solar system?
Yeah, we don't know that for sure, but it seems likely that Jupiter formed very quickly. In this game, in the game of making planets, very quickly means a couple of million years after the beginning of the solar system, the beginning being the time when a bunch of gas in between the stars collapsed under the action of gravity, started to form the sun.
Okay, and do we know how Jupiter got the way it is vis-a-vis, we're talking about how the moon and how the Earth might have been formed. How about Jupiter?
So I think the key thing is that at the place where Jupiter formed, there was more stuff. What do I mean by stuff? I actually mean rock and ice. There was more of that stuff out there. And it got together and it made something that might even have been a little bit like the Earth, but much more massive. That's the key. And when you have an object that's more massive, perhaps 10 times the mass of the Earth, it grabs gas. It grabs the surrounding hydrogen gas. And hydrogen is the most abundant element in the universe. So if you've got hydrogen lying around, it will be grabbed by a big embryo like that. And from that situation, you can go from 10 Earth masses all the way up to Jupiter, which is 318 Earth masses, most of which is hydrogen. Where the Earth formed, it just wasn't big enough in mass to grab hydrogen. And also it formed later. And so fortunately, we ended up with a nice place to live.
Hmm. Let's get back to your phone calls. This is Manan in Rochester. Go ahead.
Hi, this is Manan. I had a very interesting question, which is, as I look at the human species or human beings, and I observe every day, I myself, I do have, you know, I'm throwing away a lot of trash in the environment, not a whole lot, very little, but still I am producing trash. And for the environment, as, you know, let's say millions of people, human beings, they produce billions of pounds of trash and consumerism, which is polluting the environment of the Earth. So, you know, science, space science is spending billions of dollars on thinking of how we're going to do terraforming or live in another planet. And I think that all this money should not be spent, you know, in this field. Or as I think the human species is very wasteful and there's so much pollution and they shouldn't be going to another planet. That's my, you know, comment.
All right, Manan, thank you.
So I'm with you, actually, that we should take better care of our home. I agree with that. And we should collectively do that. Some of that requires money. Some of it just requires a change of viewpoint. And so I think a lot of it is just to persuade people along the lines that you suggest, that people should not be so wasteful. People should be more careful about their environment. Keep in mind, though, that the kind of thing that I do, even though it may seem like quite a lot of money, the Juno mission is $1 billion, it's not very much, actually, compared to the huge sums of money that we spend on Earth doing all sorts of things, playing video games, whatever the hell we're doing. You know, all of that stuff is a lot more expensive than these wonderful trips that we make to other planets.
Isn't it also likely that if there are technological civilizations that have existed or will exist, and I say that just because if the window of a technological civilization isn't very long, whether it's 200 or 2,000 or even 20,000 or 200,000 years, that's not very long in this in timescales. But if there have been technological civilizations, they have more likely than not experienced the same kind of challenges, population growth on a finite space, and then feedback from consumption of energy sources. That is not to absolve us, but it probably says we have some commonality if there have been other technological civilizations.
Let's hope so. I think that technology should not be viewed as an evil. We can use it to advantage. But we also need the right attitude, the right cultural viewpoints. Of course, if we are so fortunate, as I hope we will be, to make contact with an extraterrestrial intelligence, they may give us advice.
Yeah. Just recycling on Tuesdays is not enough. That's what they're going to come tell us. Yeah. Let me grab Keith in Brighton next on the phone. Go ahead, Keith.
Evan, I like these shows because you literally think outside the box. I got to ask your guest a question. The Earth is about 5 billion years old, correct? And
yes.
The universe is, they estimate maybe about 20 billion years.
13.7, old. 14 billion, something like that. 13.8, something like that.
Yes.
All right. So what would have happened in evolution? So let's say it's taken the Earth about 5 billion years to get where it is. But let's say if somebody got a head start on us evolving, let's say they have a 3 billion year head start. They may be so far advanced that they don't even need a physical body.
Keith,
why never see them?
Keith, first of all, why do you think any technological civilization will survive for 3 billion years? I mean, we've had a hard time with 100 years since we got rid of the horse and buggy.
Well, I think our biggest issue, and don't take the wrong idea, I think a lot of our planet's problems lie within religion. We always look for a quick answer rather than do the due diligence of science to come up with a question. And I think that does pose a problem to any civilization. And if you look back at the history of the the world. I mean, how many people have died because of religion? I mean, Adolf Hitler, who was probably the most despised human being in history, he always believed he was anointed by God to lead the Aryan race, and that didn't work out well at all.
Well,
maybe other planets went to a different direction.
Okay. Well, I appreciate that, Keith. So Dr. Stevenson, Keith, stay there. Why don't you start with some of what you've heard there from Keith. Go ahead.
So I'm not sure I want to wrestle with the religion problem. That's a difficult and divisive issue. But I think more generally, we can solve our own problems. Technology is part of it. Just general cultural attitudes are part of it. But also, I think looking elsewhere in the universe, yes, certainly there will have been planets like Earth elsewhere in the universe that got a head start on us. We don't know how long it takes to develop an intelligent civilization. That's a total mystery to us. In our case, it took 4.5 billion years. Who knows? So there are a lot of imponderables there. But I do very much get excited about the possibility that we can make contact with extraterrestrial intelligence.
But Keith, you think they might not need us just because they're much more advanced? We're primitive.
If they got a 2 billion year, even a 1 billion year head start, I think they would be so far advanced, assuming everything goes in the same way, that they would look at us like we look at paramecium and the amoebas underneath a microscope. I mean, some of the stuff that we do is pretty rudimentary. We still have people who live in tents. We can't get the simplest thing correct on a civilization, no matter how hard we try. We talk about how bad war is, but this planet is always in a constant state of war. So if you're somebody from another planet who just actually is out there but has a head start, they're going to think, why are we bothering with these people?
Keith, are you familiar with the idea called the Great Filter?
The Great Filter?
The Great Filter. Yeah, it's a concept, kind of spinning out of the Fermi paradox, which is essentially what it means is if there is going to be life that becomes technological, and maybe there's not very much of it, maybe Fermi's question on where is everybody is because, number one, they've already existed or they don't exist simultaneously, or there's something that stops life. So maybe the filter, maybe that point that stops life from becoming singular, cellular to technological is that we don't really know why we became multicellular and, sort of thinking or whatever. And that is rare and almost never happens. We somehow got through that filter and we're the example. Or maybe there's lots of us out there and the great filter is climate change. And that understanding your feedback of energy consumption and sort of mastering that is a way of being able to marshal your resources for a long-lasting future. But I guess the reason I'm bringing this up, Keith, is when you talk about a 3 billion year old civilization, it's hard for me to get my head around it. But maybe, Dr. Stevenson, if the great filter is climate change and we can do a much better job than we're doing now, then we can plan for a much longer future than we seem to have.
If I could interject
really quick.
Nobody understands what happened to the Mayans down in Central America. Let's just say, hypothetically speaking, something happened, something mutated, some food they ate affected the way they reproduced, and they couldn't. Is that a possibility that could happen to this planet? Because we're within 100 years, the planet, the human beings on this country would be gone. And that is a very, very fast time when it comes to evolution. If something mutated that human beings could not reproduce, we would be a real big problem.
All right, Keith, thank you for the phone call. We'll start there.
So here's something we do know. We know that on Earth, species go extinct, and we think that a lot of those extinctions are just part of the natural process of biological evolution. In other words, they didn't need to be hit on the head. We have this notion that the dinosaurs were hit on the head, so to speak, because of an impact 65 million years ago. Actually, that's a little bit debated, but even if true, the fact is that a lot of other species just naturally go extinct and new species arise, and that's part of the natural world. So if we are to survive for a much longer period of time, like hundreds of millions of years, let alone billions of years, we might have to circumvent what biology does to us. You're right. There may be some nasty things that could happen. There could be disease that wipes us out, mutation, whatever. If you're of an optimistic point of view, you might say that humans get so clever that they figure out how to avoid these problems. Who knows? We simply don't know. We don't know. This gets back to something I mentioned earlier in the Frank Drake equation, question of how many intelligent civilizations are out there, the last factor, the least well-known one, how long does an intelligent civilization survive? Is it a million years? Is it 100,000 years? Is it 10 million years? We simply don't know.
So before I get to Robert's phone call, stay there for one moment, Rochester, Robert in Rochester. I wanted to ask you, this, let's get really speculative. Do you think the great filter is more likely to be something like climate change, or do you think it's more likely to be somehow going from a singular cellular life to whatever we became?
I do think, and we have some evidence for this, that biological evolution is not deterministic. It's like throwing the dice or like playing a good hand in poker, except that it's much less likely. And if you look at it from that point of view, you can't make a judgment in advance about how long it takes for intelligent civilization to arise. Since we only have one example, one, I'm assuming you agree that we're intelligent in some sense.
I do.
you know, it's very hard from one example to make any assessment of this. It's still possible that we're the only intelligent civilization in our galaxy. Seems to me kind of unlikely, but the reality is we simply don't know.
All right, let me get back to your phone calls. This is Robert in Rochester. Go ahead, Robert.
I have a question about the Earth's magnetic field. It's my understanding that it has changed reverse polarity from time to time. And is this a periodic thing? What causes it? And what's it like on the Earth when we have virtually no magnetic field?
So the answer is that, yes, the field does reverse. Right now, about twice every million years. So it's actually quite frequent compared to the age of the Earth. In the past, it has reversed at a different rate. The most likely explanation is that it is a natural feature of the chaotic behavior of the dynamo, which is responsible for the field. That means you don't need a cause. It's like throwing the dice. It's what scientists call a Poisson process. And every so often, you get a double six, except it's less common than that, and away it goes. Now, when the field reverses, it doesn't go to zero. It doesn't go from plus some number through zero to minus some number, because it's actually a vector. And so the field swings, the pole swings from a state that is close to one of the geographic poles through the equator to the other pole. And as it does so, the field gets smaller, but it's never zero. And during that process, it's true that we get a somewhat higher dose of particles, a slightly larger possibility of mutation and so forth. But the suspicion is that this is never a big enough effect to have a huge consequence for biological evolution.
Is Juno mission studying magnetism on Jupiter?
The Juno mission is indeed measuring the magnetic field on Jupiter, and we're getting a lot of interesting results, including the discovery of what I think of as spots, meaning localized regions of much higher or much lower magnetic field strength, a feature that is a little bit like the sun. The sun has sunspots. Maybe Jupiter has Jupiter spots. Not to be confused with the Great Red Spot, which is a whole other thing again. But indeed, we hope over the entire length of the mission, which we hope will extend for another couple of years, to map out that field.
Here's an email from a listener named Ansgar who says, first of all, in the rather recent past, there existed a hypothesis that in the more distant past, Earth had two moons, but today has only one because the friend of poets devoured its brother over time. What is one to think of this immoral behavior today?
Well, it is indeed possible that very early in Earth's history, way back, just in the short period after the Earth formed, there was more than one moon, and the bigger one gobbled up the smaller one. You know, it's like capitalism. That's a little bit like the way planets behave in general. You know, we have four terrestrial planets, Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars. And before we had four, we probably had five. And before we had five, we probably had six. And where did the others go? They got gobbled up or scattered out or eaten by the sun. The object that hit the Earth to make the moon, we think, was about the mass of Mars. It wasn't Mars itself. But that was a legitimate planet before the Earth got rid of it. The two bodies merged, and a little bit of debris from that impact ended up in Earth orbit and formed the moon.
Hmm. His second question is, among all the planets in our system, only Saturn has rings. Why are they so stable when the nearby Jupiter exerts gravitational influence for a long time already?
So actually, all of the giant planets have rings. However, only Saturn has rings that are so spectacular that you can see them through a simple telescope. So Jupiter has a ring. It's very hard to see. It wasn't seen until the 1970s. And it is true, of course, that Saturn's rings, by virtue of ice, is very bright and very spectacular. The Uranus and Neptune rings are also hard to see. So we think actually that rings are a common feature. One of the things that makes it hard to keep a ring around Jupiter is that it's a very nasty place. Jupiter has a large magnetic field. It has high energy particles, and material gets destroyed over time. So it's actually quite likely that the material that went into Jupiter's ring was more in the past than we see now.
Before the hour is up, I wanted to ask you just about the climate of science and science research and funding now. And I don't seek to put this in the question of science versus religion. We had a listener after Keith's phone call email to say, you know, don't just assume that science and religion are not always compatible or are inherently incompatible. And I take the point. I just wanted to ask you if right now, because here we are in this country, you know, sort of grappling with an administration that didn't really have a lot of interest in NASA continuing with climate science, viewing that as sort of incompatible with what NASA's mission should be, maybe cutting budgets here and there. How do you view the worldwide disposition towards science and funding and research?
I think it is somewhat under threat. I think that currently in Washington, and in fact it's been true for quite a number of years, that there have been doubts expressed about climate change. I think that's a mistake. I think that the evidence is so overwhelming now. You know, 15 years ago, it was not so clear, but it's just so overwhelming now that this is a major problem. We should be confronting it, and the federal government should be supporting efforts to respond to this challenge to our environment. In my field, planetary science, the support in Congress, in Washington generally, is actually pretty good. I almost feel embarrassed about that. But planetary science, you know, people love it. I'm not so fond about the business of sending people to the moon, because that's not really driven by science. That'll happen.
Ego and, you know, sort of patriotic fervor, planting flags. I mean, is there a scientific benefit to going back now?
Some people would say there is. I'm not sure that there is. There's certainly science to be done at the moon. I'm not arguing against that. Even though we went to the moon, we actually don't understand everything that we would like to know about the moon. We would like to have additional robotic missions to the moon, just as we have missions to Mars. The other thing I should mention, which is, I think, a potentially major change, is that we now have some extremely wealthy individuals, and they are so wealthy. I'm talking about Jeff Bezos, yeah, for example. They are so wealthy that if they were so inclined, they could run their own space program.
And maybe we'll see exactly that going forward. So thanks to our listeners for all the great questions. And our thanks to Dr. David Stevenson, Goldberger Professor of Planetary Science at Caltech. Thank you for the expertise. I know it's been a long week, and I greatly appreciated the visit.
Thank you.
All right, short break. More Connections coming up.